Hi, this is John Shuck. Yep, it's time again for Progressive Spirit, and this week the topic is sex. My guest is John Gregg. He's the author of Sex, The Illustrated History, Volume 1.
What I wanted to do was create a greater perspective for all cultures so that people could see the world's variety of approaches to sex and know that it wasn't just one perspective to hold on to, but I wanted to offer a positive contribution for more choices for all people and cultures of the world.
Stick around. Sex is next on Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. Stay with us. For the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Shuck. Today, we are going to talk about sex, complete with illustrations never before seen on the radio. Sex, the Illustrated History, Volume 1, begins a daring exploration of human sexuality from the ancient to the modern world. Revealed are sexual practices and beliefs previously omitted or obscured from all historical telling. In a scathing condemnation of religion and its control of sex, John Gregg explores complex relationships between spirituality and sexuality. The supremacy of the mother goddess throughout most of human existence and her relatively recent fall is detailed in both word and image. These pages share graphic, erotic artworks and explicit literary excerpts painstakingly culled from the hidden treasure trove of cultures throughout history. Sex, the Illustrated History, Volume 1, traces sexual attitudes from the transcendent to the bizarre throughout the world's cultures. The often explicit illustrations are linked by historical and anthropological content, inviting the reader to experience sexuality through varied and often shocking cultural lenses. Over 300 images have been gathered by John Gregg, the author, in his travels and in his studies of world cultures, an encyclopedic tour of the sexuality of humankind. That's according to John Gregg's website about sex, The Illustrated History, Volume 1.
What really brought on the Reformation, one of the main things was that all of these Greek statues began to be revealed from early archaeology, not real archaeology, but at least they came out of the ground, and people saw all these nudes for the first time. They had been repressed to have any kind of sculptures of nudes or paintings of nudes and things like this. All of a sudden, these artists in the early 1200s saw these statues and said, oh, well, the human body is a pretty beautiful thing, really. And paintings began to appear, and a whole new sexual approach began to appear at the same time, and all these beautiful Renaissance paintings that we see of nude women. Now they had to be very careful. They had to say they were gods and goddesses, and they had to hide what they really were because the church was still very powerful. And at the same time, during the Reformation, actually, is when the witch burnings are. So the Catholic Church is reacting against this change in society and trying to keep women repressed. And at the same time, the Protestants are coming up in this period also and saying to the Catholic Church, you've got it all wrong. You can't control people in this way. And they're not basically the Protestants don't refute the basic tenets of sexuality that the Catholic Church came up with, but they do challenge the authority of the Pope. They challenge the idea of priests and things like that. At the same time, what happens is the printing press comes out, and that allows books to be printed, all sorts of books. And women are encouraged to read along with everybody else, and particularly by the Protestants. And so these things culminate in women getting a little more rights and moving toward the kind of society that we have today, where women are, in quotes, considered equal.
My guest is John Gregg. He is the author of Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. He is an historian, a writer, a researcher, educator, and traveler, has had a lifelong fascination for the beliefs and practices of people worldwide. He has taught world civilization, anthropology, American history, and Native American history and culture at the University of Florida, the University of North Florida, and other universities. He's lived, worked, and traveled extensively in Asia and North and South America, studying religious and cultural practices throughout the world. He's with me via phone from Santa Cruz, and we're talking about his book that is part one of three, Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. Welcome, John, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. That's quite a biography.
Yeah, you're quite a guy. I'm very and quite a fascinating book, and this is just part one of three. Tell me about the book as a whole, its scope, and how it fits into the three parts.
All right. I guess my background, you went into it pretty well, but I did spend a lot of time in India studying Indian philosophy and Tantra, and I'd always been really fascinated by how sex was perceived in different cultures. And studying Tantra in India particularly brought that out as a contrast to the yogic system, which is kind of a celibacy system, a system that separates men and women. And then when I contrasted that to my own upbringing as a Christian, it was even more of a contrast because the Christian church, because of Catholicism for about 1,000 years at least, tended to put sex as an evil, something to be avoided if possible. And the best way to get to heaven was to become a monk or a nun, to be celibate. And so I thought those were extremely important contrasts for humanity to look at and to understand that there's not just one sexual perspective in the world, but that there are literally hundreds, perhaps thousands, according to the culture that you happen to grow up in.
And this first volume of your series, Sex, the Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture, takes us from ancient cultures all the way up through, medieval period, I guess, well, even into the Protestant philosophies. But what are your next two volumes going to cover?
The next two volumes, the second volume covers Asia, North America, the indigenous peoples of North and South America, Australia, Africa, and the South Pacific.
One of the authors that you mentioned that you've worked on is Michel Foucault, History of Sex in the 1950s. You mentioned him a number of times in your book. What was the impact of that book, and what is new in yours?
All right. That book was really one of the first attempts to study sex as a history, and throughout cultures. He did try to go through many of the cultures of the world. Unfortunately, he was very limited by the time period that he lived in and what he thought he could say in the 1950s. As you know, our country was still suffering from a great deal of puritanical background at that time. That's the time when Hugh Hefner was beginning to put out in 1952 Playboy for the first time, shocking American culture, shocking Americans. Masters and Johnson came out with their studies on American sexuality, again, shocking America. And from that point onward, America began to move into a more open approach to sexuality and to the different sexualities. And here I mean homosexuality, LGBT, things that Foucault was not able to discuss in his time period. And that's been actually one of the shocking revelations of my book that I didn't know would occur, was that in the majority of human cultures through time, bisexuality has played a large part. And most people are quite unaware of that.
Yes, because we see the rest of this through our own current, when I say we, I guess I'm just talking about America, views of sexuality, which are pretty limited. Really, as I'm looking back through your book and looking at cultures across time, we are the unusual ones in some respects. Is that right?
Oh, I believe that that's very true, yes. For instance, when you look at the ancient world, Mesopotamia, Egypt, moving through Greece and Rome, they were basically fertility cultures. They believed that their gods had sex and enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they were free to enjoy sex themselves. And actually, there were sex festivals every month or two in ancient Egypt, in Babylonia, in Rome, in Greece. They were noted for their great bacchanals, their sex festivals, and to different gods and goddesses, Aphrodite and such, that they continually experienced a sexuality in their culture. Only with the coming of Christianity, about when it became powerful, about 300 current era, did we see a change in the Western world where sexuality became something that was hidden and actually put into the category of sin. Before that, sexuality was quite open in all of the, what we call the ancient world.
So you say 300, so that's about when Orthodoxy and the Catholic Church or the Christian Church became connected with Empire and Constantine.
That's exactly correct. That's right. 300 is traditionally the date that Constantine made Christianity the state religion. And from that point, it has the power actually to begin to take over the world, both physically and psychologically and philosophically. And it does so. And we enter a totally different period in that time where all of a sudden the Christian Church, in perhaps partially in reaction to the licentiousness of Rome and them wanting to distance themselves from that, and partially because of the taking on the Hebrew past in the Old Testament and its view of women, sex becomes an actual evil, something to be avoided, and women actually become totally second-class citizens who are not given any rights in society and held down really until the 13th, 14th century, when we began to have the witch burnings. It gets to such an intensity that women are actually considered to be so dangerous that we better burn them at the stake.
Yeah, so there's a real
very
link.
Different from a culture like ancient Egypt. You know, one of the things that the anthropologists that discovered ancient Egypt were Victorians. And when they saw a culture that was celebrating sex with statues of erect penises, pictures of erect phalluses all over the place, they simply ignored them. They did not put them in their text at all. Believing that they were too shocking for Victorian morality. And this has actually come down to us all the way to this time period, because since they neglected it, it was a tradition to neglect such pictures until very, very recently in time. And people thought Egypt was this asexual culture, where actually they were totally a fertility culture, celebrating sexuality all the time. And I find this in many, many cultures of the world that are simply ignored by the Western view, because it was too shocking to bring to the public.
You're listening to Progressive Spirit, and I'm speaking with John Gregg. He's the author of Sex, the Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. So let's talk about some of those illustrations. Your book is filled with illustrations. Tell me about some of the sources, particularly, let's go start with ancient Egypt. How did you find these illustrations?
Very laboriously. I started on the book really over 15 years ago, and I started first with my own collection. I visited India and Peru, and I took paintings, I took photographs from archaeological temples and sites in India where sexuality was very open in the ancient period. Then looking at all, as I went through all cultures of the world, I had to go through contacting museums and Wikipedia, antique galleries worldwide. I had to get permission from all of these different sources when I could find erotic paintings and sculptures. And sometimes I got permission, sometimes I was ignored. So it took a lot of research and a lot of writing to go to all these different places to try to find original pieces that I could use, because I really wanted to illustrate what, not just through writing, but I wanted people to be able to see what other cultures saw when they viewed their own sexuality. I wanted people to be able to see what they did, how they did it, how they approach sexuality. And I thought the pictures, you know, we say, we have the old phrase, the picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, in some senses, this is true, because you can actually see how the culture viewed their own sexuality. And I show, you know, even like seal paintings seals of ancient Babylon, where you would rub them on a piece of clay, you know, to get a visual image, or ancient sculptures and ancient paintings and things like this that I thought would illustrate for everyone what these cultures actually viewed when they thought of sex.
Well, let's go back to start with some of the earliest ones. What are some of the earliest images of erotica or sexuality that you discovered?
Well, the very earliest go back, depends on what you mean by sexual, but if you go back about 30,000 years ago, we had these Venus figures. Women with large breasts and large hips that were fertility figures. And we see these, we don't see figures of men from the period of, say, 30,000 years ago to like 10,000 years ago. We see all women, these big, buxom women who were fertility goddesses. And we don't know at this period of time whether there was a matriarchy, whether women were actually part of the society, whether they were in control of the society or not. We just know that the figure of the woman must have been worshipped. But when we get to the period of writing, about 8,000 years ago, when writing starts, within all of a sudden we see, and agriculture starts, all of a sudden we clearly see that men are in control, and men are taking over the world, and women become basically second-class citizens all over the world.
So it's really that agricultural revolution that made a big change in terms of women's status and the repression of sexuality?
Well, that is a major theory, at least. As I say, because there's no writing before 8,000 years ago, we can't say what actually occurred. So we don't know whether women were in charge or not, or men were in charge. We just don't know. But we do know, with the agricultural revolution, at that point, it's obvious that men assume control. From that point, we see male statues of male gods, not just female gods, but male gods, and we see a fertility thing going on where the male gods are in control and the female gods are their consorts, and together they create a fertile world. They keep the rains coming, they keep the crops growing, they keep the animals reproducing, they keep the people reproducing. So that's what we see at that point in time. And from that point onward, men have retained control in human society everywhere in the world.
And it's really that connection of, you're talking about the control, the loss of power, of agency for women, and let me ask you the question in this way. What's the relationship then between the loss of agency for women and sexual repression, or is there one?
I would say there's definitely a connection. One of the things we see at this period in time is that the hymns to the gods, the statuary, the society itself, like with the laws of Hammurabi, I'll get to in a minute, show that woman basically becomes a chattel. She no longer has any, very little, or has very little power of her own. There are a few priestesses and high positions in society that women can attain to. But for the common woman, and even for the wealthy woman, she is basically a possession of her father and then a possession of her husband. And we don't see her having any rights at that point. In many societies, not even the right to testify in court or to inherit. Very often her children are the inheritors, and they're supposed to take care of her. In some societies, we do see women able to inherit, like Rome, such as that. But Greece is a very good example, for instance. Here's a society where we think of democracy and logic and the theater, and so many of these great concepts come from, and it seems to be such an egalitarian, such a wonderful society. Well, in Greece, women were second class, not even citizens, hardly. They were called citizens, but they had to stay at home. They couldn't move about freely in public. They had no right to vote. They had no right to education whatsoever. They were basically chattels, complete chattels, for the men of their society.
And we think, though, in Greece that sexuality was freeing, right? I mean, that you think of all of the nude paintings and all of that kind of thing, that you'd think that that was a little more open.
Yes. However, the Greeks were great appreciators of the human body and great appreciators of sexuality. They lauded sexuality and thought very highly of it, and, as I say, celebrated it with constant festivals all the time to the gods, where there was a tremendous amount of sex. This sex, however, was not open to the good, quotes, the good women of society. This sex was between men and prostitutes, and men could go out and with as many prostitutes as they wanted at any time.
So it was the agency in this was men in terms of the sexuality. Women were not necessarily their own agents, and it wasn't necessarily whatever sexuality was in Greece, it wasn't for women.
Well, largely. One little aside here, dildos were very popular in Greece for the women because they had to stay home and be by themselves, and the women and the men often ignored them because they weren't even competent to talk to them because they didn't have any training or education. So men went to high-class prostitutes to talk and to discuss philosophy and discuss life, and high-class prostitutes called hatare, who were very, very well-trained, but most women were not. And most women had to stay at home. And there was even a thriving trade in dildos in ancient Greece because so many women seemed to need them.
I'm speaking with John Gregg. He is the author of Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. Let's talk about patriarchy then, and its how it manifested itself and changed sexuality, and how that might be seen through art.
All right. Since the patriarchy was in control in ancient Babylon, in ancient Persia, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and even moving into the Middle Ages with Christianity, there was an absolute control of men. So they made all the rules and regulations. They, particularly men, were very interested in making sure of who their children were, the people that they were going to pass on their rights and their privileges to. And this is one of the reasons that women were so curtailed way, way back from the Code of Hammurabi, ancient Babylon. It places women in a second-class position where they're controlled by their fathers and then by their husbands for their entire lives. And there's never a moment where they have the right to do basically anything. So this was to continue on all the way, for instance, the great society of Rome that we know so much about, because it gave so much to our modern civilization, and because the city of Pompeii that was buried in lava or lavic ash we know the everyday life of these societies, and we know that sexuality was everywhere. That in the streets there was graffiti, on the walls there were paintings. When you went to the baths, the famous baths, there were pictures of people in different sexual positions. And this wasn't just for men, though. When the men and women went to the baths at a different time of day, but the pictures were there when the women were there with their children. Sex was not a hidden thing, it was an open thing, but it was controlled by men.
Speaking with John Gregg, he's the author of Sex, The Illustrated History, Volume 1. We'll continue our conversation about this taboo topic of sex after the break. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck. Stay with us. Listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck. My guest is John Gregg. He's the author of Sex, The Illustrated History, Part 1. So now let's move ahead to Christianity. We started at the beginning of the conversation, and you said it at around 300 CE, in the time of Constantine and the time of the church becoming connected with the Roman Empire, religion, the Christian religion in this case, really had an effect on sexuality, making it evil and sinful. What is in it for Constantine as an emperor to adopt this attitude towards sexuality?
Well, I don't know. Constantine is a very interesting figure, for one thing, because he seems to have stayed a pagan for the rest of his life, basically worshiping the sun. So he was looking at Christianity apparently for very practical reasons. Christianity had grown tremendously in the empire in those 300 years since the death of Christ, primarily because it was promising something that had never been promised before. And that was everlasting life in this heaven that basically Paul, one of the later disciples of Christ, had created. And he had come up with the idea that Christ had given his life, or that God had given the life of his Son to provide this heaven for everyone. And you have to remember that the Roman Empire in those days, basically 50%, 40 to 50% of the people were slaves. And it was not an easy life. Slavery was very difficult and very hard, and they lived miserable lives for the most part. And Christianity offered them something totally different. It said, if you come and join us, we'll reward you with this wonderful heaven when you die. And so slaves in the early period were a very, very big part of the Roman Empire, and a very big part of Christianity also. And at the same time, Roman matrons and women were attracted to Christianity because of its love theme, and it's also its promise of immortality. And slowly the empire began to have a great, great many, perhaps over 50% of its people believed in Christianity. And Constantine was looking for something to unify the empire, something to pull it together, something to make it into a continuing empire. And he chose Christianity very deliberately, apparently, for that purpose. The strange thing was that as I said earlier, Christianity decided that it was going to place sex in the category of a sin, basically, because prostitution was so available in the Roman Empire, for instance. The cost of a prostitute was about the same price as a cheap glass of wine. And it was a very sexual culture. And basically people could have sex, men, again, could have sex whenever they wanted it. For instance, our word fornication comes from the foci, the columns of the Colosseum, where when men were aroused during the brutal gladiatorial combats, they could go down to the arch, the foci, and have a prostitute for the price of a cheap glass of wine. And so this was the common thing all the time, that you went down to a prostitute and went back to the games again to watch the brutality of the games. And so the Catholic Church was reacting against all of this, and having a Greek background, a lot of the early writings were in Greek, and having a Hebraic background, they viewed women as basically second-class citizens. And so women became associated with Eve in the Western world, because Christianity took up the Old Testament, and Eve was the original sinner, and so all women were considered to be under suspicion as being dangerous to entering heaven, and sex as being dangerous to entering heaven. And so the church more and more created a society where it separated itself from a liberal view towards sexuality in reaction to Rome, and became a basically a society that wanted to celebrate chastity. For instance, the Catholic Church makes a system where sex is actually forbidden for a large part of the time.
Yeah, you'd mentioned for certain days of like 40 days before Easter or 40 days before Christmas, sex wasn't allowed, and those types of rules.
Yes. What the church did was to limit sexuality for everyone for a period of 1,000 years, from, say, 300 to 1300. There was a rule that sex was forbidden on Sunday, on Wednesday, and Friday, and that reduced the days from 365 to 215. Sex was forbidden 40 days before Christmas and 40 days before Easter and after, and you couldn't have sex for 3 days before communion, and communion was quite often in the Middle Ages. So what they really did was to limit sex to approximately 50 days a year. And not only that, but they said when you do have sex, you should put a sheet between you with a strategic hole in it so that there's no touch and no enjoyment of sexuality when you're having sex. And so this was this was supposedly a rule for the common people. Now, could people maintain that? No, sex is ubiquitous, and people wanted to have sex. So what it really did was to create a control where people were considered guilty all the time, and they had to get absolved for their sin of having sex or even wanting sex. So the church basically created a revolving door, constantly bringing back its patrons to be forgiven for this sexuality that is part of human nature.
And it has resulted in just this psychology of shame that has developed for people who are religious through today.
Exactly. I certainly agree with you. Shame was a central part of the Catholic Church's philosophy regarding sex, that it was a shameful thing, and it has lived down. I say it was really bad from the year 300 to 1300, something like that, for 1,000 years. Then the Renaissance came along and things altered a little bit. But we still live, as I said earlier, we live with that in America today. Until very recently, there were all sorts of laws forbidding different types of sexuality. in America, and our views have even today of many people are really controlled by that sexuality. The Catholic Church also said you could only have one position, you know, the missionary position, the famous face-to-face position. That was another sexual rule that the Catholic Church came up with. And our society has been dealing with that in the West for 2,000 years now.
And the Protestant Reformation you talk about, take a second and talk about that too, changed it a little bit, but really didn't make a big impact in changing sexuality or women's rights for the better.
The Reformation was an amazing occurrence because all of a sudden what really brought on the Reformation, one of the main things was that all of these Greek statues began to be revealed from early archaeology, not real archaeology, but at least they came out of the ground, and people saw all these nudes for the first time. They had been repressed to have any kind of sculptures of nudes or paintings of nudes and things like this. All of a sudden, these artists in the early 1200s saw these statues and said, oh, well, the human body is a pretty beautiful thing, really. And paintings began to appear, and a whole new sexual approach began to appear at the same time, and all these beautiful Renaissance paintings that we see of nude women. Now they had to be very careful. They had to say they were gods and goddesses, and they had to hide what they really were because the church was still very powerful. And at the same time, during the Reformation, actually, is when the witch burnings are. So the Catholic Church is reacting against this change in society and trying to keep women repressed. And at the same time, the Protestants are coming up in this period also and saying to the Catholic Church, you've got it all wrong. You can't control people in this way. And they're not, basically, the Protestants don't refute the Bible. They don't refute the basic tenets of sexuality that the Catholic Church came up with, but they do challenge the authority of the Pope. They challenge the idea of priests and things like that. And so, as you just stated, sexuality, the approach to sexuality doesn't really change that much. It does change some, because what happens here in this period is that the cult of the Mother Mary in Catholicism has grown bigger and bigger and wider, and is now, like today, is one of the main cults of the Catholic popes. And here Mary is exalted as the mother of God and becomes basically a goddess again. We see a return of the ancient goddess. And for that reason, womankind begins to be appreciated a little more and gets a little more rights during the Renaissance. At the same time, what happens is the printing press comes out, and that allows books to be printed, all sorts of books. And women are encouraged to read along with everybody else, and particularly by the Protestants. And so these things culminate in women getting a little more rights and moving toward the kind of society that we have today, where women are, in quotes, considered equal. Of course, you and I both know that women still get 70% of the pay that men get for the same job. So we can't really call them a society of equality, but at least we allow them to vote. And they can work in Western society. In some societies of the world, they're not even allowed to go out of the home still. But that's the situation that we're still dealing with from our historical past.
And these changes, the right to the vote, these movements are not because of religion, but in spite of it.
Oh, yes. Very definitely, I would say that. Because the Catholic Church has never... The Christian Church in general has never done anything to give women equality. In fact, they've actually made rules, you know, that the women can't be priests. And many Protestant faiths until very, very, very recently, women couldn't be preachers. They couldn't be part of anything. They were just supposed to guide in the home and take care of the man, and that was their job.
Let's turn for a second to Islam. If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, my guest is John Gregg, and he has a fascinating book called Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. Now, I have had people say, women, feminist Muslims, say that Muhammad made things better for women. I'm wondering what you think about that. What was the impact of Muhammad on women's rights as well as sexuality?
Well, I would say the opposite of what you just said.
All right.
I think you'd have to say that Islam is a sex-positive religion, at least for men. They've always placed sex as one of the God-given joys of culture. And the Islamic culture views sexuality very highly. They praise women for their beauty. They've written books like The Perfume Garden by Nesawi about sexuality. So far as Muhammad himself, he praised female sexuality. He says a woman has a right to sexual satisfaction. And this is probably where you're getting what you heard from these other women. He says if you marry four wives, they must all be treated equally. And he says that sex should not be quickly like the birds, but should be slow and delaying. And this is for the woman, so that sex shouldn't be this wham-bam, thank you, ma'am, but a slow, gratifying experience for both people. And so Muhammad was very enlightened in that way. However, what Muhammad did do was to have a harem of his own. And unintentionally, he may have damaged the status of women by doing this and by secluding women away again off the streets. And he also declared that in war, women were chattels, so that every Islamic victory brought thousands of women to be held as slaves by their new Islamic masters. Islam, in fact, in its early days, it was very open and progressive. Muhammad said, search for learning, though it be as far away as China. His capital, or the capital of Islam in Baghdad, was open to scholars from all over the known world. And progressive Islam really changed the world in that period. They simplified mathematics, bringing in the Hindu numerals. Today we call it our Arabic numerals, that allowed for a simple math that we still use today. They spread Chinese papermaking, and they saved the ancient Greek classics. Many of the ancient Greek classics at the Christian world was allowing just to rot away because they didn't want to continue knowledge, the search for knowledge. But what happened with Islam is around the year 1100, it went into a very conservative phase. It really entered a dark age that it has not recovered from to this day, where women were placed in an even more of a low position. And they became suspicious of the rest of the world and suspicious of knowledge. And then in the last 75 years, Islam has entered into an even more fundamentalistic phase called Wahhabism, which questions everything from the West, the immodesty, the licentiousness of the West, and has actually led to the terrorism that we have today. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring sexuality out into the open, and the view of women out into the open, to create a greater perspective for all cultures so that they could see the world's variety of approaches to sex. And see, I really question how can anyone have a perspective on sex or a woman's place that they think is the correct one, that they think is the only one. I wanted to provide a viewpoint where people could see that there are all these different ways of viewing it, all these different ways that societies look at sex, and therefore see that their one way is not the right way, but just one of the ways that the choices that the different cultures of the world make.
At the very beginning of our conversation, you talked a little bit about the tantric aspect with India. For example, the Kama Sutra. Spend a few moments on that. What was the significance of that?
As you know, in ancient India, they developed the science of yoga, or meditation, a way to contact what they believed was the force of the universe, whether you want to call it God or just spirit or force of the universe. But yoga became very male-oriented also because of the Hindu culture, because of the caste system, because of the way that they viewed women as being chattels. Most yogic systems I want to separate men and women and keep men and women separated, at least when you're at the ashram, when you're there, when you're practicing, when you're, and if you want to become a truly ascendant, you're supposed to give up sexuality. So Tantra arose as a philosophy in opposition to that. Tantra believed that the whole world was made from sex. The energy of the sun on Mother Earth is the creative force that creates everything. It creates evolution. It creates life. And so Tantra said sexuality is good. And Tantra actually developed a way, an approach to the Godhead through sexuality, where people have long, intense, ritualized sex, viewing themselves as God and Goddess making the world. Tantra became very important in India and created huge amounts of arts that actually delineate all these different positions that they came up with to enhance their sexuality. The whole East had a very different approach towards sexuality than what happened in the West. They were more of a continuance of the ancient fertility aspect that we saw in Babylon and Persia and Greece. In India, in China, in Japan, sex is a spiritual force. It's not, in the West, sex was divided, and to be spiritual, you couldn't be sexual. Sex was material on the material plane and kind of bad. The spirit was on the ascended plane of going to heaven, of meeting with God. But in the East, China, Japan, they merged the two. They believed that to be a full human being, to be fully realized, to be fully spiritual, sexuality is a part of that. And they put sexuality on a very high plane. In China, for instance, Tao was developed, which was like a Chinese tantra, a specific system for men and women enjoying their sex to the greatest extent possible and moving to a spiritual level with it. And they also produced a great many paintings, as did Japan, making this sexuality into a high art form.
John Gregg is my guest. He's the author of Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture. Volume 1 we've been discussing, but in the upcoming volumes, you're going to specifically deal more with China and Japan. Is that right?
That's correct. What I wanted to do was create a greater perspective for all cultures so that people could see the world's variety of approaches to sex and know that it wasn't just one perspective to hold on to, but I wanted to offer a positive contribution for more choices for all people and cultures of the world. You were mentioning the Kama Sutra. They wanted to create a sensuality, a sexuality without guilt. They developed numerous books and illustrations of positions and techniques. The Kama Sutra is only the most famous of really hundreds of volumes that were written in Indian history about sexuality, how to approach it, how to get the most out of it, what positions to use, what techniques to use. They developed sexual toys and like swings and mirrors and penis enhancements and pacing of strokes and all these things to make sex last longer and be more enjoyable. And a huge amount of literature was devoted to this, and a huge amount of artwork from Eastern cultures, and it was actually much easier for me to gather materials for the illustrations of the book when I was dealing with China and India and Japan, Malaysia, than it was to gather art in the West, because much of that had either been confiscated by the Catholic Church or destroyed by the Church or was in the possession of private collectors or inaccessible in one way or another.
John Gregg has been my guest on Progressive Spirit. He's the author of Sex, The Illustrated History Through Time, Religion, and Culture, a fascinating book. The website is sextheillustratedhistory.wordpress.com. Is that how folks can get your book?
Yes, they can go to my site. That that site and purchase the book through that, or they can go directly to my publisher, Ex Libris, or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's basically everywhere.
All right. John Gregg, my guest, a fascinating book, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit. Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. I'm always on the lookout for interesting guests, and the more non-mainstream, the better. I'm looking for people who are telling the truth and have evidence to back it up. No topic is too taboo. This is serious business living in the empire that is run by the deep state. We need freedom of the airwaves and the internet, and we need truth tellers to expose the lies of the criminals in high places. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm thrilled to add another radio station to the list of stations that carry Progressive Spirit every week. Welcome Alameda Community Radio, KACR 96.1. Folks in the Bay Area can listen to Progressive Spirit on Sunday mornings on Alameda Community Radio. Thanks also to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit every week: WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee; WEHC, Emory, Virginia; WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina; Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown University, Pennsylvania; KCEI, Taos, New Mexico; and WLRI, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. If you enjoy the show, ask your local public radio station or even your favorite commercial station to check it out. Consider adding Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. You can also catch Progressive Spirit on your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, please share it on your social media. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook, Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, soon to be 50 years old. I'm John Schuck. Be well.